From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
We tripled aid to Africa. Africa is an important part of my foreign policy.
President Bush refuses to meet Prime Minister Tony Blair's request to increase aid to Africa. We'll speak with Sally Booker of Africa Action. Then two French journalists talk about their time in captivity in Iraq. One was held by the Iraqi resistance.
People were taken to be interrogated and maybe to be executed. And so we were there and
The other French journalist was detained by U.S. forces.
You prefer the Arabic people, you prefer the Iraqi, you don't like Americans, so we don't care about you. You are not, like nothing, like dogs.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. General Motors has announced plans to eliminate 25,000 jobs at its U.S. plants over the next 4 years. An unspecified number of plants will also be shut down. Wall Street investors responded favorably to the news. The price of stock in the company immediately rose. For the first time since the Cold War, global military spending has exceeded $1 trillion last year. The United States spent by far the most, accounting for almost half the world's military expenditures. This according to a new report by the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute. Meanwhile, a new poll shows that for the first time, a majority of Americans no longer feel that the Iraq War has made the United States a safer place to live. The Washington Post ABC News poll also found that 75% of the country feels the number of U.S. casualties in Iraq to be unacceptable. Nearly 1,700 U.S. soldiers have been killed since the invasion began. The deaths of three U.S. soldiers in Tal Afar was announced on Tuesday. On Capitol Hill, the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence met in secret on Tuesday and has approved new expansions to the USA Patriot Act to make it easier for the government to secretly gather records on individuals without a court order or grand jury subpoena. According to the American Civil Liberties Union, the bill would give the government unilateral power to let agents seize personal records from medical facilities, libraries, hotels, gun dealers, banks, and any other businesses without any specific facts connecting those records to any criminal activity or a foreign agent. Meanwhile, former President Jimmy Carter has become the latest official to call for the Bush administration to shut down the Guantanamo Bay military prison, as well as all other secret prisons around the world. The United Nations is now estimating 3 million children will die because of famine in sub-Saharan Africa as a result of the failure of the global community to meet its promises on aid. Meanwhile, President Bush and British Prime Minister Tony Blair announced on Tuesday a proposal that could write off the debts of 32 nations in Africa. But Bush refused to meet even Blair's request to double aid to African nations. We'll have more on this story in just a few minutes. In Bolivia, mass indigenous-led protests calling for the nationalization of the government continue. Late last night, departing President Carlos Mesa called for immediate general elections to pick his replacement. He warned, quote, the country is on the verge of a civil war. Mesa added, quote, by holding elections, we will avoid loss of human life. We will avoid violence that affects us all. Earlier in the day, tens of thousands of demonstrators filled the streets of La Paz for the first time since the mass protests began. Soldiers armed with rifles were patrolling the streets. In Madrid, a Spanish judge has announced he wants to question three U.S. soldiers connected to the killing of Spanish journalist Jose Coso in Iraq. On April 8, 2003, a U.S. tank opened fire on the Palestine Hotel in Baghdad, killing Coso and fellow cameraman Taras Prostyuk. A Pentagon report on the incident concluded the U.S.-led forces bore, quote, no fault or negligence. No charges have been brought yet against the soldiers in Spain, but they're being considered as suspects for murder and for crimes against humanity. The New York Times is reporting that a White House official who once led the oil industry's fight against limits on greenhouse gases has repeatedly edited government climate reports in ways that play down links between such emissions and global warming. The official, Philip Cooney, is chief of staff for the White House Council on Environmental Quality. Before coming to the White House in 2001, he was a lobbyist at the American Petroleum Institute. In a surprise move, the Justice Department has drastically decreased the amount it is asking tobacco companies to pay for anti-smoking programs as part of a deal to settle the largest civil racketeering and conspiracy case in U.S. history. The Washington Post reports the government was expected to seek $130 billion, but instead is asking for just $10 billion. William Corr, the director of the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids, said, quote, "It feels like a political decision to take into consideration the tobacco company's financial interests rather than the health interests of 45 million addicted smokers." And in Ethiopia, police have shot dead at least 11 people during the student-led protests over the last month's elections. Hundreds of protesters have also been arrested in recent days. The government imposed a 30-day ban on protests following last month's election. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Bush and British Prime Minister Tony Blair met in Washington on Tuesday for the first time since the release of the so-called Downing Street memo. The memo is actually the text to the minutes of a secret meeting in July 2002 between Blair and his senior national security team. It reveals how the former director of the British intelligence agency, MI6, told Blair the U.S. had already made plans to attack Iraq as early as July 2002. While the memo has seen relatively little attention from the corporate media, calls for a full investigation have gained momentum in Congress. Bush and Blair were asked about the memo at a joint news conference yesterday in Washington.
On Iraq, the so-called Downing Street memo from July 2002 says intelligence and facts were being fixed around the policy of removing Saddam through military action. Mm-hmm. Is this an accurate reflection of what happened? Could both of you respond?
Well, I can respond to that very easily. No, the facts were not being fixed in any shape or form at all. And let me remind you that memorandum was written before we then went to the United Nations. Now, no one knows more intimately the discussions that we were conducting as two countries at the time than me. And the fact is we decided to go to the United Nations and went through that process, which resulted in the November 2002 United Nations resolution, to give a final chance to Saddam Hussein to comply with international law. He didn't do so. And that was the reason why we had to take military action. But, you know, all the way through that period of time, we were trying to look for a way of managing to resolve this without conflict. As it happened, we weren't able to do that because, as I think was very clear, there was no way that Saddam Hussein was ever going to change the way that he worked or the way that he acted.
Well, I read kind of the characterizations of the memo, particularly when they dropped it out in the middle of his race. I'm not sure who they dropped it out is, but I'm not suggesting that you all dropped it out there. Somebody said, well, you know, we had made up our mind to go to use military force to deal with Saddam. There's nothing farther from the truth. My conversations with the prime minister was, how could we do this peacefully? What could we do? And it's this meeting, you know, evidently that took place in London, happened before we even went to the United Nations, or I went to the United Nations. And so it's, both of us didn't want to use our military. Nobody wants to commit military into combat. It's the last option.
President Bush and British Prime Minister Tony Blair at a joint news conference in Washington Tuesday. The focus of Bush and Blair's public appearance was on aid to African nations in advance of the Group 8 summit in Scotland next month. Bush announced both countries are developing a proposal for the G8 that'll eliminate 100% of that debt but neither leader gave any details on the proposal. And as chair of the G8, Blair has promised to focus on fighting poverty in Africa and addressing global climate change. But Blair's appeal to Bush to double U.S. assistance to Africa fell on deaf ears. Instead, at yesterday's news conference, the two leaders announced a U.S. aid package of $674 million. The money will be drawn from funds previously appropriated by Congress. The White House said this was in addition to the $1.4 billion the United States has already pledged to contribute to the United Nations Africa Fund. At the news conference yesterday, Bush insisted the U.S. is in fact increasing aid to Africa threefold.
We've tripled aid to Africa. I mean, Africa is an important part of my foreign policy. I remember when I first talked to Condi, when I was trying to convince her to become the national security advisor, she said, "Are you going to pay attention to the continent of Africa?" I said, "You bet." And I fulfilled that commitment. We've convinced Congress to triple aid. We've got a significant HIV/AIDS initiative that we're undertaking. We started what's called the Millennium Challenge Account, and we'll do more.
President Bush yesterday in Washington. According to the New York Times, most Americans believe a quarter of our budget goes to poverty relief. In fact, it actually spends well under a quarter of 1%. In an editorial today titled "Crumbs for Africa," the Times writes, quote, "At a time when rich countries are mounting a noble and worthy effort to make poverty history, the Bush administration is showing itself to be completely out of touch by offering such a miserly drop in the bucket." We now turn to Sally Booker, director of Africa Action, joining us in Washington, D.C. Welcome to Democracy Now! Sally,
thank you, Amy.
It's good to have you with us. Well, your reaction to President Bush's response to Tony Blair's request in the whole news conference yesterday?
Well, I think President Bush's response is completely disingenuous. It's a sham, and in fact, it's insulting. The announcement of $670 million for famine relief is money that was already approved. It is not something new, and it doesn't respond to what Prime Minister Blair came to Washington to discuss, which is reaching an agreement on a plan for debt cancellation and how to finance it for African countries, and also Tony Blair's push to get the rich countries to double their official development assistance to Africa. Now, when President Bush says that he has tripled aid to Africa over the past several years, it's simply not true. It's another case of the Bush administration using Arthur Anderson accounting in terms of coming up with numbers. The United States, for the last many years, has provided slightly less than $1 billion for all 48 countries in sub-Saharan Africa. What he's adding to that are various forms of emergency food assistance, some of the money of the HIV/AIDS initiative. This is not development assistance. These other monies appropriately are responding to disasters, are responding to needs for humanitarian relief, but they are not investments in economic development, in healthcare, in education, in agriculture. And so when Prime Minister Blair speaks about the need for rich countries to double foreign assistance to Africa, he's speaking about official development assistance. And the United States is ranked at the bottom of all the wealthy countries when it comes to the amount of assistance we provide for poor developing countries as a percentage of our gross domestic product.
Explain the debt. What does it mean to write off the debt?
Right. Well, and it requires explanation because African countries owe some $300 billion in debt, primarily to the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, as well as some of the rich country creditors. Now, this debt is based largely on loans that were made to African governments during the Cold War years. Most of this debt essentially is illegitimate. It's what's known as odious debt. These loans were made to unrepresentative governments, in many cases military dictators, in some cases dictators that the USCIA helped put in power, like Mobutu Sese Seko and the former Zaire. The money went to these individuals. It was not used for the benefit of the citizens of these countries, and it's continued to accumulate because of compounded interest over the years, even though African governments have continued to service this debt. In fact, they've paid it off several times over, but it keeps growing because of the interest. interests. Now, odious debt in the case of Iraq, the Bush administration wants creditors to cancel Iraq's debt. Iraq has some $120 billion in foreign debt. The Bush administration appointed former Secretary of State James Baker to travel around the world and get creditors to agree to cancel Iraq's debt, and he's succeeded at least with some $70 billion. The argument about odious debt has not been applied to Africa as it should be. Certainly African governments and African civil society argues that we don't owe, we shouldn't pay. But the rich countries continue to stall any final plan on debt cancellation. Now, what they're talking about right now, what's on the table, certainly represents progress. But we have to bear in mind, this is progress that has come as a result of the actions of activists in Africa, African government demands, and activists around the world, including here in the United States, that have been campaigning for debt cancellation, in many cases, for decades. It's illegitimate debt. African governments are spending more money on this debt than they spend on health care or education for their own children. These debts suck some $15 billion out of Africa each year, and that's more money than is going into Africa in the form of new loans or new official assistance or foreign direct investment. So you have this tragic irony where the poorest region of the world is in effect subsidizing some of the wealthiest institutions and economies in the world.
Sally Booker of Africa Action. Paul Wolfowitz is making his first trip to Africa as head of the World Bank and held a news conference in Washington. He's going to be going to Nigeria, Burkina Faso, Rwanda, and South Africa. This is an excerpt of what he had to say.
As I've said many times, Africa will be my first priority. It is, I think, the first priority for the bank. The bank has unique role to play in Africa, and there's a unique need for the bank in Africa.
Paul Wolfowitz, again, the former Deputy Secretary of Defense, was considered one of the chief architects of the invasion of Iraq. Your response to this trip, Sally Booker?
Well, it's, of course, a great concern to all those in Africa and here in the United States that have been campaigning for cancellation of World Bank debts, that have been campaigning for an end to the World Bank essentially dictating economic policies to African governments because it hold such enormous leverage over the finance ministers of African governments. With the appointment of Paul Wolfowitz, there's even more reason to be concerned. Activists used to refer to James Wolfensohn, the former president, as a Wolfensohn in sheep's clothing at the World Bank. With Wolfowitz, people are simply saying it's a wolf in wolf's clothing. His record as a co-conspirator and architect of the war on Iraq is very troubling in terms of what does that mean in terms of his vision of development in Africa. It's a man who has no experience in the development in the world of development professionals, of poverty reduction. He certainly has no experience in Africa. And his vision of what is required in terms of responding to Africa's enormous challenges is certainly out of sync with the visions of not only African governments, but more importantly, African people.
Last question. The UN now estimating 3 million children will die because of famine in sub-Saharan Africa as a result of the global community's failure to meet its promises of aid.
Well, this simply underscores the point that the New York Times made in their editorial, and they had it exactly right, crumbs for Africa. The chronic famine that a number of countries face, like Ethiopia or Eritrea, the food insecurity, is just a symptom of the larger issue of the growing disparities between this wealthy minority represented by the G8, the leaders who will meet in Scotland next month, and the vast majority of the world as indicative of the plight facing so many Africans on the continent. When you have this rich minority in a position of absolute control over the institutions of global governance, like the World Bank or the IMF, the U.S. being allowed to appoint the president of an international institution like the World Bank, the Europeans have their pick in appointing the president of the IMF, then you understand that we live in a political economy of essentially global apartheid, international minority rule, where these tiny minority of rich states are dictating economic rules, political rules that the rest of the world must follow if it's going to have access essentially to financing for development. But again, this issue of how famine in Africa is manipulated by the Bush administration to show its compassionate side, that's exactly what yesterday's press conference was all about. It appeals to the worst of American ignorance, to this racist preconception of Africa as a continent just of starving people, and gee, isn't the United States generous in giving more food assistance, as a way of denying the real role of the United States and other rich countries in impoverishing Africa and in dictating the economic terms, whether it's trade, whether it is investment, whether it is access to development resources.
Sally Booker, I want to thank you for being with us, Director of Africa Action, joining us from Washington, D.C. We'll be back in a minute. Music from the Angolan-born musician Bonga here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, broadcasting on over 330 radio and TV stations around the country, Pacifica and NPR stations, low-power FM stations, public access TV, as well as PBS stations and both satellite networks, Dish Network Channel 9415, Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and DirecTV Channel 375. Video and audio streaming at democracynow.org. Our headlines are now in Spanish at our website, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. It's been more than 2 years since the Bush administration began the invasion and occupation of Iraq. These have been some of the bloodiest years for journalists worldwide, and Iraq in particular. Situation remains very dangerous for journalists operating in the country, particularly those few who dare to report from Iraq unembedded from occupation forces. Today, two French journalists speak about their time in captivity in Iraq. I met them this weekend in Riccione, Italy, where I was attending the annual journalism conference remembering Ilaria Alpi, a young Italian woman journalist who was killed in 1994 covering Somalia. One of the French journalists I met, Christian Chesneau, was kidnapped for 4 months by the Iraqi resistance. We'll hear his story in a minute. But first, we turn to one of France's most experienced TV war correspondents, Grégoire Deneau of France 2. He, too, was detained for a day by the U.S. military. His ordeal in U.S. custody began in April 2004. He'd been in the besieged city of Fallujah. U.S. forces picked up Deneau in Fallujah, where he and a photographer colleague were documenting the story of the city under siege from the inside. At the time, he was the only Western journalist there. Deneau says he and the photographer were taken by U.S. soldiers along with two Red Crescent workers. He says U.S. soldiers forced them to kneel for hours, gaffer-taped hoods over their faces. Deneau says he showed the soldiers his passport, his ID, his French press identification. He says the soldiers hurled insults at him, calling him a dog, accusing him as a Frenchman of being pro-Arab. When the U.S. forces finally released them at night in the middle of the desert, they warn them, he said, that U.S. forces shoot everything that moves. This is French TV journalist Grégoire Deneau.
In April, when the American tried to come inside Fallujah, you know, there is very, very big bombing at this moment. And I was the only reporter inside the city. So it was a little bit difficult to enter the city because around the city was all the American and some Kurdish people helping the American to fight the people of Fallujah. And when I was inside, I stayed 1 week inside. And at what time I was with some people of the Red Crescent in an house, trying to find some dead people or wounded people in the morning. And the American soldier come. They saw that there is some people in this house, so they come in the house, they break the door, and I just have the time to say that I am a journalist, and so they don't kill me. But after I show them my identity card, my French passport, my press card. They see my camera. But they say, OK, we go first to the headquarters. And when we come to the headquarters, they put us... I was with a camera photographer, and with two people of the Red Crescent, and they put us, you know, something on the head. They let us in the desert in the night. And during hours and hours, they just say some stupid thing about the French people, that we don't do the war with them. We are not men. We are just like dogs. And all this time with something on the head, you know. And after during...
What do you mean something on the head?
I have my... You know, they put us... with some gaffer in to be sure that it's impossible to see nothing, and
they put a hood on your head and gaffer's tape over your head, so you look like what we've seen at Abu Ghraib when a bag is put over someone's head.
Exactly, but on this time we don't know nothing about Abu Ghraib. You know, it was before, so nobody knows about that. And when I go out, I tell my company that I have something like that happened to me. And in my company, they say, "No, maybe they are crazy. You see one American crazy people, but it's impossible that the American army do something like that." So I tell you, I was not alone. That's the truth, and I can show you something because the one soldier take the camera of my friend the camera photographer, and he say, "Okay, it's a good souvenir for you souvenir from the American. Okay, bye bye," and take a photo of us with the camera of my friend. So we have the photo of this moment, and after. After one day, they take us in a desert with a truck, and they say.
Before that, you had the bag over your head, and what did they do with you? How long did you have the bag over your head? Did you just stand in a certain position?
I stand just in my knees, you know, like I am praying. They say you have to stay like that during hours and hours. It was on the morning, and I was released during the night. So you know, it's a long day, a very long day, and they release us in the desert, in the middle of nothing, just saying to us. It was a young lieutenant. He said, "On the south is Baghdad, on this way is Baghdad, on that way, it's Fallujah. But take care, because we shoot everybody who is walking during the night." So I say, what are you doing? You are going to kill us. You do what you want. It's not my problem. That the orders, and I just let you here." And they go. So we are alive. We stay alive. So there is no problem for the moment. But it was before Abu Ghraib, and nobody knows that. But this kind of comportment for the American, you know.
When they had you on your knees for hours with a bag over your head with gaffer's tape around it, they knew you were a French journalist. Did they say things to you throughout the day?
Of course they know that I am a French journalist. I show them my press card, my identity card, my passport, my French passport. They have my camera with the tape inside the camera. They see the tape. They see that I was filming during the morning inside Fallujah, but I was filming some dead people in the street and going with an ambulance and some people of the Red Crescent taking the people to put it in the cemetery and something like that. So they see the work I was doing. They know, and they say, "Yeah, we know, but you are French. But in French, there is no journalist. You prefer the Arabic people. You prefer the Iraqi. You don't like Americans. So we don't care about you. You are not, like nothing, like dogs." And at one moment, I ask for water, and they say, "No, the water is only for the U.S. soldiers. There is no water for you."
So you got out. Did you go back to Fallujah? Can you talk about your coverage of Fallujah? What happened in Fallujah? You were the only journalist inside at the time of the first siege?
So, of course, I was the only journalist inside. So, first of all, I have to go back in Fallujah to take all my tapes, because when the American catch me, I have only one tape with me. Fortunately, I have only one tape, because they don't take all the tapes I make inside the city. And 2 days after, I go back to Fallujah. I try during 2 days, and I enter in Fallujah again. And everybody in Fallujah know that I was a prisoner, and an American prisoner. So it was easier for me to work after, because for them, I'm like them, you know.
And so what did you observe in Fallujah? Who were the resistance?
You know, in Fallujah there is some foreigners, foreigners, but the majority of the fighters are Iraqis coming from the army of Saddam Hussein. Many are coming from the army of Saddam Hussein, and some Islamists, but they are not all Islamists. They are fighting against the American because they don't like the way that the American come in the city of Fallujah. They come in the city to the people of Fallujah. You know, they were the first people in Iraq fighting against Saddam Hussein. And when the American come, at the first time, they say, "Okay, we have no problem with the American, but you have to stay just out of the city, not coming in the city. In the city, we do the job, no problem. We give you all the things that you want, but don't come inside the city." And the Americans say, "We win the war, we go inside the city." And they put the headquarters in a school. And the Iraqis, they are not very happy with that. And they, you know, you remember, of course, they at this time, they kill and they burn some four American workers.
The Blackwater.
Yeah.
Contract.
Yeah. So at this time, everything is going on. And after, Fallujah comes to be a special place for all the people who want to resist against the American. So for that, many people coming from outside Fallujah come to help the fighter of Fallujah. So you can see some people coming from Palestine, you can see some people coming from Syria, you can see some people coming from Jordan, you can see some people coming from France, some half French, half Algerian, you know, people. And so there is many people, many fighters coming from outside. But if the people come from outside, it's because the American go inside Fallujah. Before the entering of the American in Fallujah, there was no foreigners, fighters in Fallujah.
How do the Iraqis feel about foreign fighters coming in?
It depends from the Iraqi. Some Iraqis, you know, they are very strong Islamists, and they are very happy to make an international war, an Islamic war against the American and against the Occidental world. But most of the Iraqi, they don't like the foreigners fighters. They say, we it's our fighting. It's not for the foreigners to fight here. We are Iraqi. We have to save our country. We want to save our country. We are not okay with the American inside. But we don't need the foreign fighters. So for the moment, there is some problem between Iraqi fighters and foreigner fighters. But some Iraqi fighters like the foreigner fighters. And it's not all the Iraqi fighters, but there is a little problem. A big part of the Iraqi fighters say now, we have to take care, we don't have to work too much with the foreigner fighters. But they are inside now. It's very difficult to say to them, go outside. They are strong fighters, you know. So many of the Iraqi fighters are afraid about the foreigner fighters now.
Afraid of what?
Afraid because they are very dangerous. If an Iraqi fighter, an Iraqi group, said, okay, you have to go out now, we don't like you, they're afraid to be killed by these foreigners. You know, because they are very strong. There are some groups very strong. I see some groups in Fallujah, inside Fallujah. I see some group. My driver, we speak, is Iraqi. He know very well, the Arabic, and they know from which country they are coming. So he say that group they are coming from Jordan. It was a very, very, very big group with many guns and very modern guns. You know, not like the Iraqis. They have a good material to fight. And so the other fighters, the Iraqi fighter, was they was afraid about this group.
French TV journalist Grégoire Deneau detained by U.S. forces for a day when he was covering Fallujah. We now turn to another French reporter, Christian Chenot of Radio France. Iraqi resistance kidnapped him and reporter Georges Maubruneau from the Daily Figaro. They were held for 4 months from August to December 21st, 2004. At the same time, Italian freelance journalist Enzo Baldoni was kidnapped and executed. I spoke with Christian in Italy last weekend. He begins by talking about the day of his kidnapping.
Like this day, the day of the kidnapping, I was with George and our driver, Mohamed. We are going to Najaf on the Friday 20th of August, because at this moment there was a very big battle around Najaf, and especially because Muqtada Sadr, one of the rebel, the Shia rebel, was occupying the holy shrine of the Shia in Najaf, and the American army and the Iraqi army tried to crush him, and he refused to give up. So at this day, we were going there because the Iraqi government said, this is the last chance of the peace, so you have to leave, saying to Muqtada Sadr. So we were going on the way to Najaf, and 50 kilometers south of Baghdad, in a zone called Mahmoudiye, Latifiye, it's now called the Triangle of Death. We were on the wrong way, and suddenly two cars were coming very fastly, and men wearing weapons, Kalashnikov, and were taking us hostage. But it was a very rapid attack in this case.
Where did they take you?
It was, as I told you, it was near Latifiye. It's a town 50 kilometers south of Baghdad, in a zone where you have Shia and Sunni in the same place. So it's a very tough zone. There is many attacks, many bombing. It's a very sensitive zone in Iraq.
And where did the kidnappers take you, the other reporter, and your driver?
But we were on a very...
Bring you. Where did they bring you?
They bring us in a little farm, not far from the place of the kidnapping, which take place in countryside, in a very remote area. And after we are brought to a place like a farm, you know, with different barracks. And we discover after, it was a place where all the kidnapped people were taken to be interrogated and maybe to be executed. And so we were there. And we the first day we recorded the tape, and we rapidly discovered they are the Islamic army in Iraq. They said we are Sunni Salafist, we are the resistance, and we are fighting against the American forces, against the spy, against the collaborators. And so we want to check your identity, if you are a real journalist, if you are not spy. So it will take some time, and after, if you are okay, we can release you. But unfortunately for us, there was, you know, division among this group, and on the two, three first day, we could have been released, but their chief was very radical, and he said, we have two French guy, journalists, speaking Arabic, so maybe we can use them to gain something politically or, you know, on the media side. And this is why our affair take a very long time, 4 months, and because we couldn't understand why we were taken hostage for so long, because France was against war, France don't occupy Iraq, we don't have soldiers, we don't have, you know, companies working there. So there was long negotiation with the French authorities for our release.
And you made videotape, about 10 of them. Did they talk to you, since you did speak Arabic, about your being French and the difference that that made for them?
Yes, and especially at the beginning, the first word I said to them, I am French, journalist, working for Radio France, Le Figaro, because it was a cut, you know, important, because if you are in the wrong side, you are executed. And I told them, you know, if I was an American journalist or a British journalist, did you treat us like you have done until now? And they said, no, the journalist, you represent your country. So you are French, even if you're a journalist, you are representing your country. If you are American, British, you are representing your country. It means Blair and Bush policy. And so you are occupying the country. So we play this card, the French card, because we know we have some sympathy there in Iraq. And also, I asked them at one moment, because we have some discussion with them, I said, because at this time they had, I think, two American officers and one British soldier, and I said, but why don't you swap these two guys or three guys against, for instance, 1,000 prisoners of Abu Ghraib? You make a swap and you are winning, you know. And I said, no, the people in Abu Ghraib, the prisoners, they can wait. If we execute one guy, American, we cut the throat and we make a video, will have the maximum of impact in New York or London. So they are using, you know, they are playing on the fear. They are not crazy. They have a strategy of fear, which is very cruel. But they are not, they can be very pragmatic. They can negotiate people. They negotiate, for instance, the release of the Iranian consul, which is also a very difficult task because the Iranians are Shia and the group was Sunni. So they can be very pragmatic, but they can be also very cruel. We have our poor colleague Enzo Baldoni, an Italian one, and he has been executed because they said he is a spy. So it's a very horrible game.
Al Jazeera immediately reported that you were kidnapped. What role did they play?
It was not just Al Jazeera, because the most important thing when you are taken hostage is the first day, the first 2-3 days, because your life is in danger. So you need a very strong mobilization abroad, and especially in the media, not only Al Jazeera, but also in France, in Europe, to say, you, Christian and Georges, they are journalists. They are working for Radio France, for Le Figaro, because it's a kind of insurance, you know, because now the journalists in Iraq are seen by the resistance or by the Amer group or the terrorist group as a spy. So if rapidly you are not seen as a journalist, your life could be threatened. So this is why it was very important. And in the case of Al Jazeera, it was the first time that Al Jazeera take officially a position on this issue of kidnapping, saying we demand to the hijacker the release of Christian Chenot, Georges Malbruno, and their driver Mohamed El Joundi, because it's unfair, it's against Islam, it's against all the human value.
And you feel that made a big difference?
In our case, I think it was a big difference. And after we make a kind of investigation, because we wrote a book with George about all this affair, and I know that some people around the hijacker appreciate, for instance, the role of Michel Barnier, the French foreign minister, going to explain the French position in Al Jazeera, and the role of the pressure also for other Islamic group from Hamas, Hezbollah, was very important in our case.
Can you talk about who your kidnappers were?
But it was a mix. A mix of people of the ex-army of Saddam Hussein, of the ex-regime, people from the secret intelligence, from the Republican army, all Republican Guard, and they are the leader of the group. And there are also Islamist people, and also some people, a few of them, were belonging to the Bin Laden group, Al-Qaeda, maybe some of them, and some foreigners. So it's a mixture of nationalist people belonging to the old regime, intelligence service, army, all the security apparatus from Saddam. So these guys have, they have money, they have weapons, they have experience, plus Islamists, because no, it's not very interesting for them to fight with the flag of the Baath and Saddam. So all these guys are fighting with the flag of Islam and the independence of Iraq. And plus Islamist and Bin Laden people, very few.
What do you mean by Bin Laden people, since I thought Saddam Hussein and Bin Laden were enemies?
I mean, because it's a very curious thing, because during the Saddam's time, there was no terrorist group in Iraq. No, Bin Laden was not in Iraq. But after the fall of the regime, the border were all open. So that was, hundreds, maybe thousands of foreigners, of people coming from everywhere, from Yemen, from Saudi, from Iran, from all around, entered Iraq with sometimes bad intentions. And maybe some people of Bin Laden came and in all this chaos. And so the American policy in Iraq has created Bin Laden in Iraq, which was not the case before. And so we know for sure there were some Bin Laden people, because in our case, one of the hijackers said to us, I am a fighter of the jihad, of the Islam. I was trained in Afghanistan with Osama, with Sheikh Osama. You know, he don't say Bin Laden, he say Sheikh Osama, which is an honorable title for the Muslim. He said, I have fought also in Bosnia, and so I know I can manage all the weapons, even chemicals. And so the Iraq is the starting point from the Islamic revolution in the world. So for us, it's a new base. And he said, thank you, Mr. Bush, because you tried to kill us in Afghanistan, and now we are everywhere. And he said, also, we are in 60 countries. Maybe it's wrong, but he said, now we are in a state of confrontation. And at this time, it was very, not funny, but amazing, because it was at the time of the election, American election, where there was John Kerry and George Bush, competing in the U.S. election. And I said to him, maybe you will vote to Kerry because he wants a withdrawal of the U.S. troops in Iraq. He said, not at all. We want George Bush. I vote George Bush because with him, it will be more confrontation, more violence, and after 1 year, 2 years, we will be more stronger because we will be more experienced in the fighting against the Americans. So, it's a kind of very deadly game between this guy, the extremist or terrorist, as they call them in America, and George Bush putting, fire and, oil on the fire. And so this is very, I think, dangerous and very gloomy for the future, because now we are really in a kind of clash of civilization.
French journalist Christian Chenot, kidnapped by the Iraqi resistance for 4 months. We'll be back with him in a minute.
Calendar must.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman as we return to French journalist Christian Chenot of Radio France. Iraqi's resistance kidnapped him, and reporter Georges Maubruneau from the Daily Figaro, as well as their driver, held for 4 months till December 21st, 2004. I asked him if the videotape messages his captors made him make gave him hope that the government, French government, was negotiating for his release.
During all the 4 months of captivity, we have made roughly 10 videotape, and it was a kind in the framework of the negotiation between the French and the hijacker. So it was very simple. It was, you know, you give your name. My name is Christian Chenot, working for the French radio. I am in good health, and we are, for instance, the 5th of June 2005. Huh? And so it was very short tape, and it was a kind of proof of life for the French negotiator, because they want to know if we are in good shape to negotiate. And so we make this kind of threat of tape, but we make also some threats, you know, threatened tapes. You know, for instance, they said to us, now your situation is very critical, so appeal to your government to do something, to find a solution. If not, you can be killed at any moment. So you make the tapes, and you are very afraid, of course. The tape we recorded in Arabic and in English. Said, I appeal the French government to do something, because the situation is very critical for us. And if you don't do something, please, please do something, because we'll be killed. And so these tapes were sent to the French government, and after...
And after 4 months, you were released. What happened on that day? Did you understand you would soon be released? Where were you released?
Yes. In fact, we have some signals, you know, 1 week before, 3 days before, because we make a tape, a videotape, 3 days before, and it was a very strange videotape, because it was a tape they shot us, you know, the front, the back, and walking, because they say the French wants to know if you are in good health, you can walk and you are okay, you know, your health is okay. So they shot us in different point of view, and both and together, because all the tapes were made separately, me and after George, and for the first time we made the tape together. So it was a proof, an evidence for the French, so we are two, we are in good health, and so the release could happen. So 3 days before, we knew something, we were on a good track.
And where were you released? How did you get out of Iraq?
It was a very strange release, because we imagined before that we should be released, for instance, in a mosque or in a kind of natural place, you know, a mosque, I don't know, a place, or an embassy, you know, Arab embassy. And in our case, we were released not far from the airport on a motorway. It was 4:30 p.m. It was sunny. And the coffin, you know, the back of the car were open. And I jumped and I discovered the blue sky, the French embassy cars. And they said, come on, it's finished. And I saw the hijacker with the Kalashnikov. They have a kufier, so I couldn't see their eyes. And it lasts, you know, 2 minutes. But what was very strange, it was, you know, in a traffic jam, you know, the cars was, you know, going everywhere, and it could happen anything. It was a very sensitive moment, because maybe a U.S. patrol could happen, and you see, you know, people with guns, with the French embassy, and everything can happen, you know. It was the case with Julien Sgrena when she was released after, on a checkpoint, American soldier shoot at a convoy. For us, it was very miraculous, you know, to have nothing. And for the French Secret Service, it was very a success.
Was it done at night or in the day?
No, it was at night. It was 4:30, but it was shiny, you know. In Baghdad, it was so it was the sunny. And so we were released at 4:30. And at 5 o'clock, we were in the house of the French embassy. And immediately after, of course, we have a bottle of champagne, just a glass of champagne with the French ambassador. And after, we have been debriefed by the French intelligence service for 3-4 hours, you know, saying everything, because it could be useful for other hostage. And voilà. And after, we spent the night in Baghdad, in this house. And the morning after, at 9 o'clock, we have the French ambassador. He came with his vehicle, his big car. And we have been, and we went to the airport, passing the checkpoint. And the French were very, not worried, but afraid that we don't, our visa has been expired, you know. So we fear that at the checkpoint, at the airport, at the control of the passport, maybe the Iraqi said, your visa is finished, so you have to do something. And maybe there can be some confusion. And there was all the commando of the DGSE, the French intelligence service with us, the French ambassador. So they were afraid that something could happen. But finally, it was okay. And the French military airplane came from Amman, coming to pick up us back to home.
And your driver, Mohammed?
It was another story because Mohammed, we were, with him 2 weeks, the first 2 weeks in this farm near Latifiye. And after 2 weeks, me and George have been transferred to near Baghdad, in the west of Baghdad, but he stayed alone behind us. And after, we discovered that he has been released in Fallujah the 12th of November. So roughly one month before us. And he was fined by the American. And he was interrogated 1 or 2 days, and after he was released. So it was also another big story.
So as you watch the news now, now you're back in France, what is your assessment of what is taking place?
But my assessment is very gloomy because I think the situation in Iraq is chaotic, will become more violent. The violence will continue because you have a climate of revenge, of violence, and there is no political solution. The political solution is not there. And especially, I think now, the Iraqis are paying the price of the American mistake from the beginning, because they opened the borders, they dissolved the army, they dissolved the Baas party, all the things, and all these guys, with the border open, all the extremists, the radicals came, could enter in Iraq, and all the people of the army, which was not all bad, you know. It's not, with Saddam, you know, 80% of the army could have been recycled, you know, and on the police, on the secret service. But on the contrary, all these guys are now in the resistance. This is why we discovered them. They were officers in the army, in the secret service, and no, they have their gun, they have their money. So I think they are paying the price of the mistake, and now I don't see, positive things in the next, few months. So the only solution, and the Americans are starting to think about it, is to include the Sunni community, but not just the Sunni community, the people of the army, of the ex-secret intelligence, all these guys, that could be very fruitful for the stability of Iraq. But you have to recognize your mistake. And the problem is not the Shia and the Kurd. People are on the top of the state. So maybe for the moment they don't want this guy coming back, not to power, but to the state. You know, it's not a question of power. But if you say one side of the country, you are criminals, you are terrorists, how can you build a new country and especially unify Iraq? So I think we are now in the slope of Lebanization. It means you have three big regions, the Shia in the south, the Kurd in the north, the Sunni in the west, Baghdad in the middle, and you have a very weak central state, and the periphery is starting to enjoy autonomy. And so the chaos will continue. So this is why, and especially when you look at the election, which was an achievement in itself, because for the first time the Iraqis could vote, But when you read politically the election, it's also the beginning of the liberalization, because the Shia votes for the Shia, the Kurds vote for the Kurds, and the Sunni, they don't vote. So you are basically making a sort of communitarization of the country, and so I think for the future it will be, I think, a disaster.
French journalist Chrétien Chenot. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.